have reservations about going back to restaurants. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, as the governor plans to announce how Florida will reopen, we'll talk to some local restaurant owners about their thoughts, whether they're planning to reopen their doors to customers. Would you go out to eat next month? Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, how one brilliant Jacksonville High School senior got accepted to all 8 Ivy League schools. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the COVID crisis. As of Tuesday, more than 1 million COVID-19 cases have been recorded in the U.S., and at least 58,356 Americans have died. That surpasses the number of Americans who died during the Vietnam War, where fighting lasted more than 10 years. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 32,846 cases, 1,171 deaths. And Florida actually set a new single-day high in deaths on Tuesday. Between Monday morning and Tuesday morning, 83 people in the state died from the virus, the largest single-day increase in the state since the outbreak began. Now, here in our area, Northeast Florida, there are 1,653 reported cases and 42 deaths, including a new one reported, a 52-year-old man in Duval County. And Duval has become the first county in our area to hit 1,000 cases. Now, amidst all of this, we saw yesterday Florida Governor Ron DeSantis giving a news conference in Washington with the president, and he is expected to announce his plan today for a phased reopening of the state. That's drawing criticism given the spike in cases and deaths in Florida. Also this week, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry says local businesses should also soon reopen their doors, but in a phased approach. That includes restaurants. Now, the COVID crisis, as we all know, has hit the restaurant business particularly hard as they've been closed to in-room dining and have shifted to takeout and delivery only. As April heads into May, local restaurant owners are trying to figure out whether and how they will open back up to seated customers. How is this going to work? Well, this morning we're taking a closer look as we welcome Allison DiRizzio, the co-owner of 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Also on the line, Lauren Titus, editor of Edible Northeast Florida Magazine. Hey, Lauren.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Would you go out to eat next month when Florida sees a phased reopening of business? Or would you feel uncomfortable, worried about perhaps catching coronavirus? How do you plan to handle the restaurant business, yourself, your family, your friends? What are your thoughts about the reopening of the state? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And you can let us know your thoughts on Facebook. Well, Allison DiRizzio, let's begin with you. You're the co-owner of 1748 Bakehouse on Main Street in Springfield, Main and 8th. For those that want to check it out, full disclosure, I love the place. I've gotten takeout from there. It's absolutely delicious. You have pivoted to takeout and delivery only since the pandemic began. So what's your current operating status there?
So we moved the chairs out, the dining tables, and the cooler case are now in the dining room where the seating used to be. And they are a bodega-style grab-and-go. And then we're doing family meals and order fulfillment in what used to be our bakery case, and hopefully will be someday soon.
Right. So as we hear Governor DeSantis say he's going to have a detailed plan for business to reopen next month, you know, restaurant owners are watching this closely. What are your thoughts about how you will pivot back, if at all, to in-room dining at your establishment?
Well, Melissa, we feel like we just got into a healthy rhythm. We just don't feel particularly safe opening up our dining room without more science coming out, asking our employees, our families, our customers to run that risk. You know, we've only been open 6 months, and we've completely pivoted the business model virtually overnight, and now we're being asked to change it again. One of the things that's been floated in Florida, I know they're doing it in Georgia, where they're asking people to take out tables to keep the distancing to 6 feet. We just don't have that luxury. We're a small space, and taking out tables would leave us with virtually no seating for customers.
Okay, so then it sounds as though you're going to stay the course for the time being. Just keep business open to take out and curbside pickup, and that's it?
Yes, for the time being, we've talked about maybe putting some, we have very little space outside, but maybe putting a few extra tables outside. But the summer months are rapidly approaching, and it'll be too hot to comfortably sit out there. So we're just really unsure with no vaccine, no real antibody test. It just seems not prudent to put our staff and our customers at risk.
Even though you could make more money in the short term, at least, if you did
that. We could, you know, but at some point you have to say, what is a life worth? And we are surviving on our current business model. I bet we're not doing quite as well as we were before, but we are making it. We're able to make our payroll. And our employees really have always come first in our business. And it's just, it's a very, it's not as easy as just opening the doors and having people come back in. What do we do with their dirty dishes? We have counter service. People line up. So not only do we have people sitting, but then we have, you know, a long line to the door most Saturdays. And then there's the question of, are people going to feel comfortable enough to come back in?
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I'm not sure my customer in particular would be comfortable to come back, sit back in elbow to elbow with people.
Sure. And let's bring Lauren Titus now into the conversation. Lauren is the editor of Edible Northeast Florida, a gorgeous magazine. You can pick it up everywhere. Just covering all things food in our area. Now, Lauren, Allison mentioned Georgia. The governor there, Brian Kemp, has come under fire for opening restaurants for dine-in service already. Some Atlanta restaurateurs have decided to do what Allison is saying she's going to do, not to fully reopen. They even took out an ad in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution explaining their decision, a group of restaurant owners in Atlanta and Savannah saying that they just didn't think it was safe to do this. What are you hearing from food folks and restaurant owners around the region about this issue?
Well, obviously, business owners want to get back to business and get back to pre-COVID-19 life, which is not going to happen for a long time. And the business owners, the restaurateurs we've been talking to are very, very hesitant, just like Allison has said, about reopening. One fear is there's a recurrence of the virus and they have to go through this all over again. Why rush into this when, you know, another month or two? Granted, it's a tremendous strain on their businesses, but for the safety and the health of the community at large, why not wait another couple of months?
Let me ask you as well, Oren. Lauren, if a restaurateur is trying to secure a PPP loan, a paycheck protection loan from the government, can their decision about reopening or not factor in?
Well, you know, the clock starts ticking as soon as they get that money, and they have 8 weeks that they have to satisfy some of the conditions of the loan. So that puts tremendous pressure on the restaurateurs who might, you know, by a miracle have gotten some of that money. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed blessing to get the loan. So, you know, they may get the loan and not be able to fully open again if there's a limitation on the number of diners. So it's a real challenge all the way around.
We heard Mayor Curry this week say that he sees the opening of restaurants in a phased approach, maybe having just a few tables, making sure everyone inside is wearing a mask, and other sort of precautions like that. Are some restaurants planning to go that route?
some restaurants are prepared to go beyond what the government says are the conditions for reopening because, quite honestly, they're very worried and concerned about the health of their employees and their customers and themselves. So they're definitely trying to figure out how best to do it. Allison mentioned, you know, the plates and the silverware. What about menus? You know, do you hand the same menu to customers one right after another? Do you have room in your dining room to spread out 6 feet, if 6 feet is even enough? And what about the ventilation system? Does that carry the droplets from customer to customer? It's something that each restaurateur is taking into consideration, and some are going to have an easier time, but some, like a fine dining establishment, may be extremely challenged to figure out how to accommodate that and preserve their dining experience. Why would you want to go out when you have such limitations on the pleasure of dining out?
Right. We all miss that, of course. I think just about everybody misses being able to go out to eat with friends, sit down at a table, have a waiter take your order, enjoy the social aspect of it. We're all missing that. But certainly people have to put their health and the health of those around them first. And as we talk about this, if you're just tuning in, as Governor Ron DeSantis later today says he'll announce a plan to reopen Florida, even though cases are spiking in the state, we're speaking with Allison DiRizzio, the co-owner of 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield, and Lauren Titus, the editor of Edible, the Northeast Florida magazine that focuses on food and the culinary world. Lots of calls as we ask you. We want to know, would you feel comfortable going back to eat in a restaurant next month when some businesses will have a phased reopening? This is on the advice and plan of the governor and the mayor. What do you think about this? It's 549-2937 to join us. Ryan is in Arlington. Hey, Ryan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Hey, so I know in our family, we'll be back to visit the restaurants. We got, you know, some local places that we like to go, as well as we're looking forward to getting back to it. But one of the things that I've been thinking about is, you know, how many restaurants are going to be around in 3 to 4 months, because so many people are out of work. Even if everything disappeared, the coronavirus disappeared tomorrow, so many people have gone without pay. A lot of the patrons aren't going to be able to afford to go back. So
yeah,
kind of your thoughts on that.
Sure. Thank you for that, Ryan. Allison at 1748 Bakehouse, you and your husband are food industry veterans. You were able to quickly pivot your business model to keep afloat,
right,
keep your payroll going. You know what you're doing. That said, a lot of restaurants aren't going to make it through this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think they're not, and I think Lauren touched on something with the fine dining. It's easy to take a sandwich or a salad to go, but fine dining hasn't had that luxury. You know, that it's still, it's not a daily occurrence that you would go to, you know, an expensive dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, but I think that one of the things about taking your families back to restaurants right now is, like, our business in particular, we thrive on the community aspect of it. We're elbow to elbow on a banquette. The tables are industry set apart, but still close. Neighbors at tables often talk to each other. And with the absence of that, what is the alternative? It's quiet. It's maybe a bit uncomfortable because of the lack of people. And, you know, so that is something to consider. But as far as people in the industry, he's correct. There are a lot of people who've lost their jobs right now. We have not seen a decline in our business in particularly, but a lot of folks have.
Yeah. Lauren, you've been tracking that. What are you seeing in the sector around the region?
It's funny. We were prepared to do a neighborhoods themed issue this summer, and we're concerned about for readers to vote on their favorite eateries in 30 different neighborhoods across the region. We're concerned now that many of the restaurants that we have listed in those neighborhoods may not open back up. So that's definitely a strong possibility. You know, the restaurant business operates on such a small margin to begin with, going from week to week, maybe if a restaurant's lucky, month to month. So something like this that's so disruptive is a huge challenge for restaurants of any size.
Sure. And, of course, that's what's driving the impetus by the mayor, the governor, to allow for reopenings. They are worried about businesses going under. That said, will the customers return? 549-2937. Carmen is in Jacksonville. Hi, Carmen. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Okay, I agree with most of all things that have been said previously, but our country basically cannot go back to what it was in the past. And for people out there that are hungry, and I get that, and out of desperacy, I know they want to open up businesses because they have to make money. People are hungry and things like that. But if someone has died in their family or they know someone that has been affected by this virus, then their mindset would totally be changed. And to open up the restaurants and things, you still have people that are still not understanding social distancing. I'm in the stores, and even though they have exits, people are still just walking by like they're not even understanding that. So even when you open up the restaurant, it's just going to be human nature for people to want to talk and get closer to each other and all that. So, you know, the restaurant business, I feel really bad for it. I've been in it before as well. But there's going to have to be a phase of people to be retrained, to do other types of jobs, unfortunately. And just like Ryan said, they're not going to have money even to go out and eat. I love fine dining. It's what I live for. But I'm also, you know, a cancer recovering person. And so I am scared of everything at this point. And I know it's going to be extra hard for restaurants to come back and as the one lady said, to clean up. And who's going to do the dishes? I mean, I feel like the paper industry will really go up because that's what we're going to do. And I see some
paper plates,
like
you mean. Paper plates, yeah, or exactly. Takeout. Yeah.
Paper goods.
Sure.
Throw it away.
Yeah.
And even though it's fine dining, you might have a nice steak on a paper plate, but it's still a nice steak. But places like Carrabba's and things like that, I still see them packed. I still see people doing, you know, the pickup and delivery. So the food industry might have to go to something totally different, and we just might have to have people retrained for other things right now. It's probably going to be the next couple of years.
Right, Carmen. I hear you. And stay safe, yeah. Carmen. I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you so much for that. Tom is in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Tom. What do you think? Tom, are you with us? Hey.
Hi, sorry.
Sure.
My biggest concern is the liability of what happens if the contact and tracing comes back to my restaurant.
Tell me about your restaurant. Tell me about your restaurant.
We've Meehan's Irish Pub and Seafood House. We're on the bayfront in St. Augustine.
Oh, I love that place.
You know, we have outdoor seating, we have indoor seating. However, it's really scary what the potential liability might be that we have no idea. And there's no direction coming from OSHA or workers' comp.
So Tom, will you in May then not reopen?
We are anticipating staying closed until the governor's order declares it safe, and then after that, we'll make a decision if we think it's safe.
And are you able to make payroll? How are you doing financially? Did you apply for a loan?
We've been closed since March 20th. Completely closed. We're not doing takeout. We're not set up for takeout. Our food doesn't travel well. So we're hunkering down and hoping that by staying closed, stopping spending money, and retaining our resources, that we can effectively reopen when it's safe to reopen and employ our staff once again.
Well, best of luck, Tom. I love your establishment. That's Meehan's Irish Pub and Seafood House right on the bayfront in St. Augustine. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, and Allison DiRizio at 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield, how concerned are you about liability issues with
absolutely.
You are.
There has been, we reached out to our insurance carrier, and, you know, they just don't know. This is obviously everyone knows this is unprecedented. And with the tracing, you know, what would happen to our business if we became a hotspot? It would ruin our business, whether, you know, we were taking every safety precaution imaginable if it were to be traced back to us. And I'm just, you know, it's not just the financial liability. It's the liability of knowing that we contributed to, you know, perhaps someone's death or a family getting sick, or we're just not willing to take that risk. It's, you know, if you were told that there could be a possibility that your meat that came in had, you know, E. coli in it, would you serve it? No, you wouldn't. You would get rid of it and you would start over. And that's how we feel.
And let me get a few tweets and emails on the air. Julie tweets the show, "This experiment might show many citizens just aren't ready to take chances with their health. Simply because the government says we can doesn't mean we should. I'll be taking the reopening very slowly." Joss tweets us and says, "I support this and I hope more companies will allow people to work from home now." Another tweet from Eric, "I empathize for local businesses, but my family will stay with takeout for the foreseeable future until a vaccine is developed. It's just not worth the risk." And on Facebook, lots of comments. Sherry says, "I have reservations. Ha ha, that's funny. Seriously, I'm confident things will get back to normal at some point. I'm looking forward to a more normal time." And we have a couple of emails from listeners. Here's one from Marilyn. "How are we going to eat and drink in a restaurant while we're wearing a mask?" Lauren Titus, what about that? What's the point of sitting down in a restaurant to eat dinner if you've got a mask on?
Right. So, you know, it's interesting if you look at national polls and even local polls, 70% of Americans believe that the restrictions in place have been effective, and they don't want them lifted too soon. Who wants to go through the past 2 months all over again? You know, we know that life is going to be different, but do we have to go through these periodic lockdowns like this if we can just wait a little bit longer? You know, people really believe that we should first and foremost try and slow down the virus by keeping people at home. That everyone understands that business is, you know, is going through a debilitating phase right now. But the health and safety of the communities at large are really what most people are more concerned about.
Joe emails and says, Joe writes, "Nudge some of our community leaders to mirror what other cities are doing. Drive-in movie restaurant service." That's interesting. Thanks for that, Joe. Dale is in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Dale. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
We have a small bed and breakfast in Green Cove Springs. We've been operating it for 22 years, and we're running into basically the same problem. We're a Victorian-style bed and breakfast that's decorated in antiques, and we also do a country style, which is around a large table in the dining area. All the customers come down and we eat at the same time, and we are just trying to find out some parameters that we can work in. We're the same way. We don't want to be a hot spot. We don't want to get anybody sick. And in the same way, we do not want people, you know, getting us sick either.
Of course.
It's just my wife and I, and we were just trying to figure out, being decorated the way we are, the flat surfaces, I mean, we've got antiques. We have furniture everywhere, different sizes, different shapes, you know. Where do we go?
Sure. You know, Dale, this has been brought to my attention. The James Beard Foundation has a guide on its website for businesses like yours to reopen. That's the big culinary guru, jamesbeard.org. If you go there, they have some tips and resources. And what's the name of your business?
It's the River Park Inn.
Well, good luck, Dale, and I really appreciate the call. Green Cove Springs is such a great community. Thank you for the call, Dale.
No problem. Thanks for taking the call.
And Allison Dorizio at 1748 Bakehouse, let's end this with your final thoughts about how you see the next several weeks for the restaurant industry. What do you think?
Well, for the restaurant industry at large, it'll be interesting to see who opens and who
keeps their current business model, whether that's being closed or continuing just to do takeout and curbside. I think that customers, I think humans are savvy, and they understand that this is not over simply because there's an economic toll on an industry or on the economy in general. So I actually see very much like what's happening in Georgia, that a large number of dining establishments will stay open. My guess is that some of the chain restaurants will open and some of the fast foods will open back up, but I think the independents will stay closed for the most part.
And Lauren Titus, you'll be covering that in your magazine, Pick Up Edible Northeast Florida. And 1748 Bakehouse has lots of delicious food for takeout and curbside pickup. Check them out online. Check out any restaurant in your neighborhood that is offering this service and support them however you can. So thank you, Lauren, and thank you, Allison, at the Bakehouse. Thank you both so much for joining us today. We'll keep following this. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Much more still ahead on the show, meanwhile. Later in the hour, African Americans and coronavirus, why the pandemic is hitting them especially hard. But up next.
Schools and physicians are the number one reporters for child abuse and neglect.
The pandemic and kids, some ideas on protecting them from abuse and neglect from the Children's Home Society of Florida. That's next.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today. April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and Electro Lounge Radio 89.9 FM HD4 celebrates the heritage and history of jazz every Sunday from sunrise to sunset. So tune in to Electro Lounge Radio 89.9 FM HD4 or online at wjct.org/jacksmusic and explore the roots of jazz from old favorites to fresh new jazz. We play it all every Sunday on Electro Lounge Radio. Jazz, America's original art form, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT.
The Voidcast from WJCT is a musical journey through Northeast Florida. I'm the host, Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw. Join me while I cut through the digital noise to share hand-picked local music stories. WJCT.org/Voidcast.
Welcome back. Well, this month, April, is Child Abuse Prevention Month. And the Children's Home Society of Florida is sounding the alarm about how the COVID pandemic and stay-at-home orders could actually be increasing incidents of child abuse and neglect. I spoke about it with VP Tara Hormel. Take a listen. Tara Hormel, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Cases of child abuse and neglect were expected to spike as the COVID-19 safer-at-home orders took effect. What are you seeing and hearing about this issue across Florida right now?
Well, as the orders were put in place to protect the population as a whole, you know, with families being at home, you know, they are now not in schools and not attending the doctor as regularly as they would under normal circumstances. Schools and physicians are the number one reporters for child abuse and neglect. And they, you know, we've seen a decrease in calls to the abuse hotline statewide. Calls were down 4,000 fewer calls in the month of March than in the month of January. And that does not follow normal trend.
Sure. So what is the Children's Home Society doing right now to try to provide support to kids out there and their families?
Multiple ways. One is that we have gone virtual. We went virtual almost overnight, ensuring that our team members had access to technology so that we were able to reach families and replace what were face-to-face visits with video conferencing. We are still meeting with families for our dependency case management cases. We are still going to the home, just conducting the home visits outside. You know, we want to make sure that we're protecting our clients, you know, in addition to being able to connect them with services that they need, whether that's behavioral health, or early childhood intervention, particularly in the Jacksonville area.
Sure. And with the unemployment situation being what it is, economic hardship, isolation, or for people that do have to work, they might have to leave a child at home without anyone supervising them. There are so many stresses on families right now, right?
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Even in the cases where families are able to work from home, they're also now responsible for being, you know, homeschooling their children as well and trying to help their children through their academic day in a very different environment than what their children are used to. So even in the best of circumstances, it's still challenging for families.
So how can people support the Children's Home Society of Florida?
Well, as we are now closing out Child Abuse Prevention Month, it is really multiple ways. One is making sure that we're all keeping our eyes and ears open for things that don't look right. As, you know, just when I go for my walks in the evening, you know, you see families playing outside and we're paying attention to different things now than what we used to. And working for a nonprofit organization, we are all mandatory reporters. However, the public as a whole, you know, we each have a responsibility to keep an eye out for the children of our community and report something that doesn't feel or look right to us. The other is just to know that help is here. If a family member or a family is experiencing challenges, there are services out there that can help, and CHS is prepared to help during these times.
Thank you so much for that. They are the Children's Home Society of Florida, a statewide leader on protecting children for over a century. You can find them online at chsfl.org, and she is Tara Hormel. Tara, thank you.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Well, as we've all come to learn, the COVID crisis does not discriminate. It can and will strike any human being, whether they are young, old, healthy, or infirm. That said, we do know the elderly are more likely to die from the virus, and the data increasingly shows that African Americans and Latinx people are suffering disproportionately from coronavirus. A variety of factors is driving that, and we want to shine a light on it right now as we welcome Barry Wright Jr., MD, an internist with Baptist Health in Jacksonville. He's on the line. Hi, Dr. Wright.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm okay. And it's so good to have you on the show. There are a number of factors that are affecting African-Americans and Latino patients of coronavirus that you're seeing. Can you take us through them? Why are these communities suffering more greatly?
I think some of the social determinants of health, that resulted in a lot of current disparities, such as increased mortality, say, for heart disease, diabetes, AIDS, even infant mortality. I think a lot of those social determinants are impacting the African-American community or even other minority communities in this epidemic. And we're just seeing it a lot more prevalently and a lot more dramatically, I suppose, given the unprecedented nature of this. One of them... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So So one of the aspects that we look at, a lot of times housing is, you know, one of the aspects. So if you're in an area where housing is a lot more dense, simply because of, you know, perhaps due to lower paying jobs, you may not have a larger swath of land. We know that increases your exposure to individuals. It makes it more difficult to pursue social distancing. The other one is educational factors. We've noticed that some individuals in the community aren't necessarily keeping up with the traditional news outlets. You know, they may, you know, be more tuned into, you know, certain radio stations or certain TV stations, you know, or not at all. Maybe they don't have, you know, cable or television. So as such, we're seeing that the information isn't getting out to those areas. You know, additionally, we've seen that, you know, the testing sites aren't necessarily deviating towards those communities. We have certain major hospitals, you know, whether it be UF, Sands, whether it be Baptist, you know, Mayo or any of those, even the freestanding where you could drive through and get the testing, those aren't necessarily focused on some of the communities that could be considered hot zones. So one of the things that we've talked about as the president of the Northeast Florida Medical Society, where we help to address a lot of these issues, is getting mobile testing to where we can specifically target these areas. And as a result, be able to more aggressively negate the spread of this pandemic.
Bring me up to date, Dr. Wright, on the effort to get more mobile testing sites out in the communities. Where is that?
Well, right now we're coordinating with a number of organizations. You know, I mentioned one of them is the Northeast Florida Medical Society. We're actually a group of probably about 80 physicians in the Northeast Florida area, Jacksonville and surrounding counties, you know, and the associated patients. We've coordinated our, you know, efforts. We're working also with the Urban League. We're working also with the Hispanic Medical Society and also a few other entities and even the National Medical Association with a lot of presidents across Florida. And then the city's actually been very generous and be able to engage these discussions. One of the things that we found was initially an issue was we couldn't necessarily derive the accurate epidemiological data that we needed to be able to more insightfully, you know, target the areas that we needed to target. But we've noticed that those efforts have been progressively extended in order to be able to facilitate that. We've also had, you know, some talk with the with on the state level. Additionally, since they've taken over the testing or the initiative, not taken, but I've been very instrumental in being able to facilitate a lot of these things, and we've seen great conversation on that front too.
Now, Jacksonville has been ahead of the curve when it comes to aggressive testing compared to a lot of other cities. But that said, we're only testing a fraction of the population overall. We've got to ramp up more widespread testing all over, don't we? To even begin to get a handle on this and contact tracing too.
That is absolutely the case. And we've been advocating for that also, even expanding the testing recommendations. I know initially it was limited, perhaps due to limited testing supplies, after just those patients that demonstrated symptoms, you know, those patients that were higher risk, the elderly, you know, maybe needed hospitalization. But I think we more aggressively need to test even those that have been exposed. And we've seen in many of the nations that essentially implemented widespread testing. That was the key in helping to get ahead of the pandemic and preventing it from spreading. Because as we know, even studies out of Switzerland showed that about 50% of individuals that have COVID are asymptomatic. Additionally, in the United States, we've seen that one out of every 10 persons generally tends to test positive for the test. So I think there's definitely a large swath of the population that will be symptomatic and spreading it without necessarily knowing that they're spreading it and not being conscious of some of the standardized precautions that we've recommended.
We're speaking with Dr. Barry Wright, internist with Baptist Health, on the impact of COVID on people of color. Income inequality, food deserts, higher rates of diabetes, you've talked about all of those. People of color are more likely to be in what are now deemed essential jobs, where they have to interact with the public, that's driving it too, isn't it, Dr. Wright?
That's definitely one element of it, definitely. You know, and I think, you know, before, I guess, if we think of the way it spread, it started, you know, in China, you know, we had a, you know, the outbreak started to go into Europe, and then we started to see with the traveling, initially it was in a predominantly Caucasian community, but then those individuals that are more exposed or consistently, I suppose, part of the essential jobs that are on the front lines many times, in the service industries where, you know, they can't necessarily work remotely. They can't necessarily facilitate their business via Zoom conferences. We are seeing that exposure is increasing the spread additionally.
Okay, so with all of that said, there's one other factor that you wanted to talk about, how African Americans have a historic distrust of medical professionals because of eugenics experiments, the Tuskegee scandal, where black men were intentionally infected with syphilis and other horrific examples from history. Is that a factor in this too, in your estimation?
You know, I'll say I've seen that to be the case. It's one of those aspects that's a little bit more subtle. Sometimes it's a little bit more pronounced. You know, we do know that, you know, even the thing, even go back way earlier into the 1800s, when the father of gynecology, Dr. Sims, you know, he began experimentation on slaves, you know, to essentially to perfect some of the gynecological interventions that we see today. You know, going back to eugenics, which fortunately became out of practice, but you know, the last forcible sterilization occurred as recently as the 1980s. I think it was in 1981, but that was also something that was prevalently supported by medical societies. And then we, you know, many of us have heard about the Tuskegee experiment, which went on for about 40 years, starting in 1932. Even as recently as 1969, the CDC supported it, but ultimately, you know, with programs like this, as this information got out to the public, you know, there were outcries that essentially helped to push back these sort of things. So, you know, even working in a hospital, I know just as recently as last week, you know, I took care of a patient that had severe heart disease. His heart pumped probably at less than half of the efficiency that a perfectly healthy heart would. And he adamantly refused any intervention from the cardiologist, you know, from any of the other clinicians that were working with him. I happened to be one of the clinicians that came on the case on that day. And with the conversation within several minutes, I was able to convince him to get a procedure, essentially a catheterization, where they would be able to unclog his arteries and help to facilitate the recovery of his heart.
That is great news.
As I finished having the discussion with him, he looked at me and specifically said, "I will do it because you recommended it."
That's wonderful. And I want to thank you for your time, Dr. Barry Wright, Baptist Health, on the line for us. People need to listen to the health experts right now. Thank you, doctor, so much for being
thank
with us.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Now, in a moment, we're going to take a break from all this pandemic coverage and share the incredible story of a Stanton High School senior who got accepted to all 8 Ivy League schools. We'll speak to him next.
Marks Gray, dedicated to helping Florida's businesses manage their complex legal issues for more than 120 years. Marks Gray is proud to support WJCT and public broadcasting. Learn more at marksgray.com. Offices in Jacksonville. Baptist Health wants you to stay as healthy as possible by helping you find a primary care doctor who understands your needs, goals, and preferences. And Baptist primary care physicians now offer secure online visits. More at 904-202-4YOU.
Borough Market in London is one of the oldest food markets in the UK. It's also the place itself, a business advantage.
We knew that this business really relied on surviving in Borough Market because it's such a busy destination point for so many people.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, selling honey while surviving this pandemic, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
As thousands are finding out at great cost, America's meatpacking plants are some of the most dangerous places in the country. Workers have been sickened, and the nation's largest meat company says the food supply chain is close to a breaking point. We'll look at what coronavirus is doing to the meat industry and its workers next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Voidcast from WJCT is a musical journey through Northeast Florida. I'm the host, Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw. Join me while I cut through the digital noise to share hand-picked local music stories. WJCT.org/Voidcast.
Welcome back. The Global Women's Leadership Organization, She Is Fierce, is looking for the positive in this pandemic. Founder Kelly Youngs is leading an online Zoom conference Silver Lining series with women business owners. Recently, she spoke with Jennifer Ernest of Chef's Garden Catering and Events. Jen and her husband had to find a way to pivot from catering big events to delivering food and fun to customers virtually. So they came up with virtual cooking classes. People all over the country are taking part in them. I've done it too. Take a listen.
I spent a couple days saying, take a deep breath. Luckily, it was beautiful weather. I was able to enjoy some sunshine, which is a blessing that we've all had in Florida. And we decided that Monday we're going to wake up and get a plan. My husband was like, I think we should do meal delivery. Gas is low when we've got a lot of people that can drive and vehicles. And I had seen some friends that were talking about like virtual cocktail hours just with friends. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is how we do these cooking classes. We just virtually connect with people. And it really happened that quickly. We had a conversation on Monday with our catering director, our general manager, my husband and myself, and we put some menu ideas together. We got our first order, which was amazing. I actually had a friend calling saying, are y'all going to do meal delivery? And I was like, I'm so glad you're asking. This means what we're doing might work.
It has worked. It is a great thing to do. You can sign up for a virtual online cooking class with Jennifer Ernest and her husband at cateringjacksonville.com. You can check out the She Is Fierce Silver Lining series on Facebook or at sheisfiercehq.com. And what's your silver lining in this pandemic? Email us that at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and we'll read some of those emails on the air. Well, finally this hour, he is the valedictorian this year at Stanton High School in Jacksonville. That's a huge achievement all on its own because Stanton is the smartest of the smart, right? But how about this? 18-year-old Craig McFarland also recently received acceptance letters from all 8 Ivy League universities. Craig's incredible feat was just profiled in the New York Times and lots of other places. He's taking a break from his intense studies to get on the phone with us. Hi, Craig. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
And congratulations. I am so in awe of your achievement. You got accepted to all 8 Ivy League schools. That is incredible. Congrats.
Thank you. Yes, thank you so much.
How in the world did you do that? You must study 24 hours a day, my friend.
No, ma'am. I mean,
please don't call me ma'am. Ma'am is my mom.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Not really. Like, of course, studying is a necessity, but I found that if you just pay attention in class for the most part and, you know, genuinely do your homework and check your understanding, then studying isn't really going to be a time-consuming task.
Wow. Well, you're very modest because I know how hard this is. You have a weighted 4.98 GPA. You've been studying French, Spanish, and Arabic this year. You will be the valedictorian at Stanton, although the ceremony won't happen till July. You got accepted to 17 top-tier colleges and universities, not just all 8 Ivy League schools. Duke, Emory, Georgia Institute of Technology. You got a full ride at Florida State and UF. So
yes,
I think the question everyone has for you now is, where are you going to go to school?
I fortunately and unfortunately have to decide that in 2 days.
Oh, wow.
One thing that, like, one huge clarification that I, like, made on my New York Times Facebook post, I was able to receive a full ride scholarship to all my schools receive the qualified for fluoride. So right now I'm lucky in the sense that I don't have to really use cost as a decision.
However, very lucky. What school are you leaning towards?
Right now it's, I would say, Yale, Harvard, FSU, and Stanford.
Hey, why not just go for Harvard? Just go for the top of the top, right?
I mean, of course, Harvard is an amazing institution, top of the top academically and prestige-wise, but I'm not necessarily looking for just prestige or prestige at all. My only goal, really, in college is to, like, just be happy and to live and hopefully get a good education as well, and I feel as though...
You're going to get that. There's no doubt about that. Well, you know, my hat is off to you. And by the way, I have to tell you, I told my kids about you and I said, why can't you be a little more like Craig?
Oh, no.
Because obviously you have worked so, so hard and I want to congratulate you and let us know what you decide. I think everyone's very curious to hear.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
He is 18-year-old Craig McFarland of Stanton. He's the valedictorian at Stanton, and he has been accepted to all 8 Ivy League universities. You can check out his story in the New York Times or on our website at WJCT.org. Craig, take a break, okay, after graduation, just a little
one. Yes, I've been enjoying this coronation as much as possible.
And I'm sure your mother is very, very proud. Tell her congrats from me as well, and best of luck.
Thank you. I will.
All right. That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is the scintillating Heather Schatz. Main man Josh Torres drives this ship. He's our show director. Jessica Palumbo is our intrepid news director and our brilliant and totally collegial digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. He is a gentleman and a scholar. Your emails mean so much to us. Keep them coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, you can check out the podcast at wjct.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow to connect with you then. Keep calm and keep in touch. Talk to you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.